How many Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram photos have you seen of blueberry picking adventures, salmon drying or smoking on racks, goose soup, moose stew, rendering seal oil? The list goes on. Alaskans love the rich bounty the land and waters of our state have to offer and proudly show their unique versions of curing, drying, fermenting, or putting things in freezers or jars. Storing food for winter is an ancient tradition, and we're talking about it today on Talk of Alaska.
Today's program is underwritten in part by Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters.
Hello, it's Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend. A few years back, in a display of pamphlets on food preservation from the Agriculture Extension Office, I noticed one of them outlined the process for canning walrus. I loved how Alaskan it was and how it normalized walrus in a jar as part of our food culture here. Alaska journalist and Anchorage Daily News editor Julia O'Malley is working on a book and assisting with an upcoming project at the Anchorage Museum all about Alaska food called How Alaska Eats. Julia wrote, "To eat at our tables is to understand our culture." She joins me now to discuss her food writing work and this project. Julia, hello.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks so much for being here. Also in the studio with us this morning is Liz Snyder. Liz is an associate professor at UAA in public health. And she just recently finished being a polar lab scholar in residence at the Anchorage Museum. Hello, Liz.
Hi, good morning.
Thanks so much for being here. You're also helping with the upcoming museum project titled What, Why, How We Eat.
I am, and getting to work with some fabulous ladies in the process.
All right, and you Alaskans can also join our conversation. Do you have a favorite Alaska food story, recipe, harvesting method you'd like to share? What's your favorite Alaska comfort food? Give us a call statewide at 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-8255. If you're calling in Anchorage, the number is 550-8422. 550-8422. You can also email us those great recipes, alaskatalk@alaskapublic.org. It's nice to take a break from the heavy news cycle and talk about something enjoyable that we all share in common, food. Everybody has to eat. Last week, I was in a grocery store and saw someone with a t-shirt that said, "Got a gutuk," and I've seen the t-shirts that say, "Got muktuk." This seems quintessentially Alaskan, although I had to remind myself that Midwesterners wear fake cheese blocks on their heads. So, I don't know, maybe it's one of those things that happens everywhere. How did this project come together, and how did you become involved? Julia, let's start with you.
Well, I guess I just... What is it about Alaska where if you just keep on doing the same thing after a while, people be like, oh, yeah, she's the one who knows about that thing.
She's the expert. I
began in 2015 looking at the question of wild food and climate change. And so in that way, I did some traveling and thinking and writing about sort of how Alaska eats and our relationship both to the outside but also to climate. And so that and the book is the sum of that work will be collected in the book as well.
And tell us a little more about the book project, and then let's talk about the upcoming museum exhibit, and we'll get Liz here in the conversation. Tell us about the book.
The book is a collection of food writing that I've done mostly for national publications. And so like The Guardian and Al Jazeera America, and then more recently for the New York Times dining section. And in between those reprinted essays are recipes for foods that have sort of a historical or cultural tie to sort of how we cook and eat. And that came out of a bunch of historic cookbook research that I did. But also some of my traveling and sort of looking at subsistence culture. And also the way in which subsistence culture has, looking at the way in which subsistence culture has really influenced cooking as a general matter, you know, over the last 100 years. So the recipes are sort of culturally significant in some way. And those go with the in between the food essays. And then also there'll be some interviews that with people talking about some of the themes in the exhibit. And those interviews will also be made into videos that will play in the exhibit.
All right. If you're just joining us, this is Talk of Alaska, and my guests this morning are journalist and editor Julia O'Malley, who is working on a new book about Alaska's food culture, and Liz Snyder, who is an associate professor of public health at UAA and a recent Polar Lab scholar in residence at the Anchorage Museum. And she is also working on the exhibit at the museum. You can join our conversation if you'd like to share your favorite Alaska food memories, recipes, maybe your harvest methods, or what your comfort food of choice is. Our numbers are 1-800-478-8255. That's statewide, 1-800-478-8255. In Anchorage, it's 550-8422. 550-8422. You can also email us talk@alaskapublic.org. So Liz, I know you have to leave at 10:30, so we've only got you for half of the show. Tell us about your work as a Polar Lab scholar and your role in the museum project, how those two kind of came together.
Sure. I think as Julia started out, when you work in this area in Alaska, things happen kind of organically, so it's hard to pinpoint exactly where a jumping off point is. But with my work at the university, which is focused on food systems, food security, and being on the board of the Alaska Food Policy Council for the past 6 years, where we advocate for growing our local food economy, ensuring lower income families have access to safe, healthy food, that our food is safe in times of emergency, and also conducting the research behind that to support the policies that we're advocating for. And that really opened our eyes to the need for a center of some sort to support that type of work and train our next generations of workforce in this topic area. So in working with the museum, we explored some ways to develop that workforce, develop some partnerships between the university and the museum, and me being able to collaborate on this upcoming exhibit is one of what we're hoping are a variety of examples of collaboration.
Well, I can see the sort of natural intersection of your work in public health at UAA mm-hmm. and food and safe processes. So talk about what that's going to look like, this work that's coming together to help the next generation of folks that need to know how to safely handle food.
Right. And across the spectrum, there's so many different aspects to the food system and handling food safely in a variety of cultural ways and based on past history and new traditions. That's one aspect. What we're building here at the university at UAA in collaboration with a colleague, Rachel Miller at APU, is putting together a center. We're calling it the Food Research Enterprise and Sustainability Hub of the North, or Fresh of the North. And we're in the middle of a soft rollout here, but that's another collaboration point with the museum. They're assisting us with our website. And when we do a more intentional rollout, we will be providing opportunities to facilitate collaborative research. We've got some funding to develop some food systems courses across varying levels. And then building that connection between the university and the Food Policy Council as well.
So, Julia, I want to get you back in here now. How do you think, and Liz, I'd love your comments as well, how do you think Alaskans compare to residents in other states when it comes to connection to local food? I grew up in Wisconsin where, of course, cheese, homemade sausage, pickled fish were big items. How do you think we're really different, or do you think that this is just every state, every geographic area has a connection to what grows locally there or lives locally there?
Well, one thing that makes us different than a lot of other places is the kind of annexed quality of Alaska, this sort of distance from the larger economy of food and a dependence on that larger economy on one hand, but then something that's really baked into our culture. And I would argue that the largest cultural influencer on our food culture is subsistence and all of the different aspects of subsistence, but is that idea of survival. And also the idea of being capable and practical. And I think those are words that really are part of how we see food here. And that has to do with, you know, the fact that we are isolated from the larger, you know, economy. Mm-hmm. It takes time to get here. And there's always the sort of specter of not getting what you need, you know, from outside. So I think that's one of the things that makes our food culture different or defines it. Here.
And do you think that because of that, people have to be a little more creative and a little more, resilient when it comes to working with what you have?
Oh, absolutely. And you see that in the cookbooks. You know, if you're looking at the cookbooks from the early part, you know, like 1910 or 1920, and, you know, you see that cooks are like trying to be creative with what's available and what's cheap and trying to go easy on what's expensive. But also, you know, and what I have learned, because another component of this project is that I've crowdsourced all the recipes and crowdsourced lots of the sort of components of the things that are helping us to formulate the exhibit, but is that people are substitutors, you know? So I've been writing these recipes where it's like, okay, here's a recipe, but you could use these six other different things. And that's how we cook here. It's just baked into our cooking culture, is that, you know, using what you have and knowing all the different substitutions. So it's like, well, what can you sub in for an egg? Mayo? You can make a cake with just like a, you know, a fresca or whatever. You can use a seagull egg. You know, there's all that kind of stuff. And that's just baked into how we cook. People are resourceful. They are practical. They are adaptable. And I think adaptation is another word that's really part of our food culture in a way that's unique.
So, Liz, what are your thoughts about the uniqueness of Alaskans and how we may or may not differ from other places?
No, I think Julia hit on it. I think other words that come to mind are resiliency.
Right.
We're a resilient crew up here. Self-reliant. I think that's in the Food Policy Council's summarizing ethos. We talk about this a lot. We import about 95% of our food. If you talk to folks who do some of these calculations, we've got 3 days of food on our shelves. If we were to have a disruption to our port, more immediately, we have a port here in Anchorage that's under pretty great disrepair, and the threat of that is some could argue, imminent. So having those skills, not just to deal with the scarcity that we deal with in the immediacy, but also having those skills ready should things get a little more challenging.
Let's talk a little about the exhibits that will be part of this museum project. There's going to be interactive learning aspects to it with dinner tables. Mm-hmm. What's that about?
Do you want to start with the dinner table, Julia?
It's in development right now.
the dinner table is not
this
yet
is being
set
designed,
yet.
But the table
the
exists.
The table exists.
Yes. But the idea would be that people would be able to, like, because there's a whole piece of food and eating that has to do with ritual and, you know, from how it is that we cut the fish to how we set the table to, you know, there are all kinds of different smaller ethnic groups that have like certain ways they do things. So theoretically, there will be like a demonstration component of the exhibit where people will be able to share and demonstrate sort of the rituals that they have around food.
All right, let's go to the phones. Ron is in Dillingham, and I should remind folks that we're talking about Alaska's food culture today. And journalist, editor Julia O'Malley, who is working on a new book about Alaska's food culture, is in the studio, as is Liz Snyder, an associate professor of public health at UAA. And we're talking about all things Alaskan when it comes to food and our connection to it in our culture here. 1-800-478-8255 is the number statewide. 1-800-478-8255. In Anchorage, it's 550-8422. 550-8422. And you can email talk@alaskapublic.org. Let's go to Ron in Dillingham. Hi, Ron.
Hey, good morning. Hey, I just want to share with you, I know there's lots of good recipes out there, but folks probably don't want to give them up and share them perhaps on the air, but this is really, I'm not much of a cook, but I got one snack that I like to make that must be enjoyed over iconic Alaska crackers, Alaska cookies, Pilot bread. And it's so good that people end up licking the bowl half the time, but I take a quart jar of red salmon that I've canned myself, my wife and I've canned, and I mix mayonnaise, about a quarter block of cream cheese, and mayonnaise to whatever consistency you want to make. The more mayonnaise, the softer, the more mayonnaise you put in and that you want it, and a little bit of garlic, a little bit of onion salt, and a little wee bit of sweet pickle relish, and the final ingredient, just a little cap full of a thing called Wright's liquid smoke. Just a cap full, you don't want to put too much, and just whip it all up, and it's something we enjoy over Pilot bread, and usually after taking a good hot steam, and then my buddies, I always tell them it's a secret recipe, but I actually learned it from some missionaries in a little village called Chignik many years ago, and it's very simple. Doesn't require a lot of cooking skills, but and you make it to your own taste. Whether you want more mayonnaise or more cream cheese or more relish, some people don't like the relish, but I've literally seen people licking, they take their fingers and lick the bowl and it's all gone. people just love it, and it's very healthy.
All right. Well, it sounds good. I'm getting hungry now.
We'll be right over, Ron.
Yeah, Ron, get that Pilot bread out. I'm glad. Thanks so much for the call, Ron. And I'm glad he mentioned Pilot bread because that's one of those things that I'd never seen before I came to Alaska. So what's known about the origins of Pilot bread?
Well, I don't know about the origins so much, but there are these foods that are shelf stable. I think shelf stability is like a real influencer in terms of how recipes have been developed. And so when it's fun to, for one thing, a salmon spread recipe, kind of a base recipe similar to that is going to be in the book. And it was developed from the crowd online. And no food could really be more Alaskan than Pilot bread with the salmon spread. But there's a list, and it'd be fun to have actually listeners to tell us more. But there is sort of a list of foods that we're looking at for sort of a pantry portion of the exhibit, and they are these like shelf stable sort of nostalgic foods. So we got the Pilot bread, we got the Tang. What else were we
must
talking
have
about?
Condensed milk.
Spam.
Mm-hmm.
Spam on it. Condensed milk.
Anything in a can.
Yep.
And dry milk.
Oh,
too,
God.
Powdered milk.
Powdered milk, and then the canned fruit cocktail with the waxy cherries.
Oh, yeah.
Mm. Yeah. There's like a lot of cake recipes that actually call for that you can find. But it'd be fun if people have other ideas for sort of classically Alaskan shelf-stable pantry foods to add to our list.
Which, as a public health professional, is also challenging because, on the one hand, you are promoting access to food and nutrition. And on the other hand, so many of your shelf-stable items are not the healthiest choices.
Absolutely.
Right? I would love suggestions on healthy options with your shelf stable.
That's just sort of like a vein of things, mm-hmm. without any, but we do know that especially if people don't eat shelves, especially if you follow like a classic Alaska Native diet looking at proteins and vegetables only, and that's high in healthy fat, and you avoid shelf stable diets, it does, cause better health outcomes. However, our food culture does have this, we have a taste, right. for these certain things that have been available across the state in village stores. And yeah, it's complicated. I mean, mm-hmm. soda would be like right at the center of that.
So, Liz, kind of staying on that vein of food processing or shelf stable, Alaska has a real lack of regulated food processing facilities.
That's true.
Especially for commercial sale of meat or other food products if people want to make things. So in your work that you're doing now, what's mm-hmm. on the horizon for technology and systems, maybe for small businesses to safely process food and meat and other products to be able to sell them safely?
Right. I mean, when we talk about diversifying your economy, the food economy is one that has so much potential. And I think adding our processing capability also joins the conversation with increasing our infrastructure around food storage. because that's important for keeping it through the seasons. It's important for distributing it. It's important for even growing our export business beyond just the fisheries end of things. But you do bump up against a little bit of a chicken or an egg challenge, right? Do you invest in new processing capabilities before you have increased production to be sending to those facilities? So it's that part's a little challenging. One thing that's not as well recognized, and there are some folks here in Alaska trying to do a better job of mapping out the facilities, but we do have quite a few processing facilities available, maybe in existing restaurants, in schools, in community centers. So figuring out ways to communicate their availability, to coordinate their availability, I think that's one smaller, more accessible step in that direction.
All right, let's go back to the phones for a moment. We got some calls eagerly stacking up here. Jim is in Eagle River. Hi, Jim.
Hi, good morning. I thought I would share with you my first experience with native foods. In 1977, I flew into Kiana and with the intention of meeting someone the next day. So this was in November, and I, to kill some time, I took a walk up the Kobuk River. So Kiana is situated about 70 miles upriver from Kotzebue. And as I was walking, this old woman waved me over to her cabin. And so, of course, I went over there, and she invited me in. And she'd been cleaning her Coleman stove with a goose wing, scouring it. And we were talking, and then she brought up foods, and she said, "Have you ever had this? Have you ever had that? Oh, let me share." So she pulled out some foods, and she says, "Now, as a white man, you'll like this." And she gave me some dried whitefish, and I said, "Oh, yeah, that's really good. And you'll like this, too." And so she pulled out some smoked sheefish, and I said, "Yeah, that's really good, too." And she said, "But you won't like this." And then she gave me a taste of seal oil, and I said, "Yeah, I need more practice with that." So
that was an artful answer.
Turns out that she was, I didn't learn this till later, that she was this really kind of famous elder in the village, and mostly famous for how many husbands she had outlived. And what a wonderful hospitality. Now, if I have enough time, I can tell you the next day I went up to visit Jackson Henry, who I had originally planned to see. He was a blind man who'd been blind since he was 19, but had never learned any skills like travel and braille and the such, and he wanted, because we'd opened up a new center for the blind, he wanted to get these services because his mother was getting old and he wanted to be able to get a job, so he had Social Security when he retired. So I got directions to his house, excuse me, and all the houses in Cayenne at the time were just plywood houses, no paint. But because they were all that way, it didn't seem unusual or shabby at all. So I knocked on the door, and his mother answered, and she was expecting me. Her name was Bessie Henry, and she was famous because she had just won the fancy parky contest that she made in Kotzebue the year before. And she invited me in, and when he heard me in, Jackson appeared out of the corner of this one-room cabin, and he had a blanket over his corner of the cabin. Then he came out and greeted me warmly, and Bessie, and he said, "Oh, you have to have breakfast with us." So we had sat down and had breakfast of Krusty's pancakes and moose liver. And I also have to tell you, as I walked in, there was a stove in the middle of the room to supply the heat. And in front of that was a moose hind quarter thawing on the floor.
Mm.
And one more factoid, if I may, it's not related to food, but some of the things that I was thrown into and learned in this visit. Jackson told me about how they used to use jade ulus because jade was so common in that area.
Yeah. Well, thanks, Jim. We need to move on, but that's an excellent point about using jade as a tool for cutting meat and fish, and the idea of Krusty's pancake mix and moose liver is just that interesting intersection of off-the-shelf foods and, you know, local subsistence foods, which Alaska is so well known for. Thanks. That was a great story. Elizabeth, I know you have to leave us soon. So sorry, Liz.
Oh, no worries.
So I wanted to ask a little more before you go about the museum projects and the public programs.
Right.
And if those are fleshed out yet, what are we talking about for the public? Is it cooking demonstrations or classes, or what do you envision there?
We are still brainstorming this out, but we have mapped out what the exhibit will look like, some of the different thematic rooms or sections, if you will. So trying to talk about it without giving too much away so people are excited to come see it, but recognizing our history, our food history in Alaska, the diversity of cultures that we have here, some of the new up-and-coming modern opportunities with respect to food, the collision of those two, and some of the different roles that food plays in different aspects of our lives, from the personal to the public to the technological. We're trying to highlight all of that, and it's going to mesh really nicely with some of the other programming that happens there. We've got the Urban Homesteading 101 program, for example. I'm not sure if we're going to have any intentional overlap with that, but stay tuned.
Well, and how would you say, when you're doing this research, how has a changing climate affected the way that people preserve their food, smoking, drying, other methods, fermenting and other things? How has that really challenged people's methods?
Sure. I'll kick that off, and then I'm going to look over at Julia because I know she's been thinking about this a lot. But climate plays a very large role in the exhibit. It's hard to escape because it does affect our shipping routes. It affects the thawing of our storage cellars, particularly in rural Alaska. On the flip side, it may open up broader opportunities for growing different varieties of foods up here. We've got folks trying out wheat varieties and barley with great success. What else is on your mind, Julia?
Oh, man. That's a lot of it. When climate changes the weather, it changes the patterns of a lot of things. You know, not the weather. When climate changes and there are more storms, for example, it changes the patterns of where the ice is, and that changes how things are for our hunters. When it's wetter, that changes sort of how things grow. There are parts of climate that are not understood but are probably factors in changing the patterns of migration for marine mammals and also caribou. Caribou's need to get to food, and there's a whole sort of constellation of factors that have to do with snow and temperature. And, there's all kinds of things that have kind of gotten sideways, you know, if we look at the traditional elders of knowledge, as we have started to see an increase in temperature in soil and air and water.
We are going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll take a whole host of calls and other questions as we continue our conversation on Alaska's food culture on Talk of Alaska.
Talk of Alaska is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Want a fulfilling volunteer opportunity educating and protecting your community? As a trained Medicare counselor, you'll help stop fraud and connect people with the benefits they've earned. You can make a powerful difference for Alaska seniors. Learn more at medicare.alaska.gov or call Alaska's Medicare Information Office at 800-478-6065. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We are discussing Alaska's food culture with journalist and Anchorage Daily News editor Julia O'Malley. Julia is working on a new book and is helping and is taking part in this upcoming museum project about Alaska's food. And it's the title of the project is What, Why, How We Eat. Is that right, Julia?
Well, it's a working title.
Oh.
Yeah, my book project's probably going to have something to do with, like, how Alaska eats. But also, I should mention that I'm, you know, there's a component of it that's also part of the crowdsourcing is that all of the recipes are pushed out in a newsletter that's called How Alaska Eats. It's a it's an Anchorage Daily News project, too. So
right, yeah.
Yeah.
So you're highlighting different recipes and processes in that newsletter.
And we have this sort of groovy online test kitchen where I post up some of these historic recipes and we sort of test and modernize in the test kitchen. And I do a lot of cooking with the guidance of that group. So there's that too.
A groovy test kitchen sounds...
It's on Facebook.
Sounds groovy.
Yeah.
Let's go back to the phones for a moment. John is in Anchorage. Hi, John.
Hello. I have a couple of recipes for raspberry jam. My sister-in-law down in Oregon was the one who discovered that if you put raspberry jam on top of a frozen salmon fillet and broil it for 15 minutes, it comes out absolutely perfectly. It's a total surprise. But try it sometime. I know a lot of people make raspberry jam, and the idea of putting it on a salmon fillet that's frozen and chucking it into the broiler seems a little strange, but try it, and you'll be amazed. The fillet should be, a couple of inches below the electric burner or the electric broiler. The other recipe is taking raspberry jam, mixing it with about two-thirds marmalade, and putting in a teaspoon of red pepper flakes. Try that on toast. It's a great treat.
It'll wake you up, I'm sure.
Yes.
Well, that does sound interesting. I could see why raspberry would pair well with salmon. So that part of it doesn't surprise me. But the process, the idea of putting it frozen under the broiler, I love that idea because too often I go home after work late and think, oh, great, didn't get anything out. What am I going to cook? Mm-hmm. So it's great
to know. Exactly. That's exactly the truth. I mean, so many times I wanted salmon, but I didn't want to unfreeze it. And the first time I tried this, I thought, nah, not going to work. It worked perfectly. The salmon is beautifully moist and
And scented with raspberries. Well, thanks so much, John. Thanks for that great recipe and idea, and I'm sure people will try it. Julia?
I was just going to say that recipe speaks to the importance of the freezer. I think, will certainly be represented in the exhibit, but our relationship to the chest freezer is another piece of Alaska's culture, that's food culture, that's sort of different and pronounced. It's just a very... food preservation, food processing is just like a larger kind of piece of our daily life than it might be other places. And I will say that there is a raspberry jam recipe in the book.
All right.
Right. Hits right on it.
And it can be slathered onto a piece of salmon, apparently.
Yeah, apparently.
And thrown under the broiler.
Yes, exactly.
I like that idea. Let's stay with the phones for a moment. Thanks so much, John. Janice is also in Anchorage. Hi, Janice.
Hi.
Did you have
Can
a recipe? Yes.
No, I don't have a recipe. I have a question for Julia. There used to be bags of peas from the valley and small containers of peas. Every summer and the end of the summer is a big treat, fresh peas.
Yep.
I haven't seen them in the last few years. Do you know why?
I have noticed that as well, and I don't know. And maybe there is somebody who's been involved with a farmer's market listening who can call in and tell us more. But that's something I've missed at the farmer's market as well. That was a big pea freezer.
Yeah. I had forgotten about that until Janice mentioned it. But yes, I remember seeing those lovely bags of peas and have
there
not
was
noticed
some,
them
There
well.
Were some challenges with E. coli having to do with birds, I think. I think that was the thing. But I don't know that has anything to do with it.
We're talking about Alaska's food culture today on Talk of Alaska. Journalist and editor Julia O'Malley is the guest in the studio, and you can join our conversation if you have great food memories or your favorite Alaskan comfort food that you'd like to discuss. 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-TALK if you're calling statewide. In Anchorage, it's 550-8422, 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. Charles is in Sitka. Hi, Charles.
How's it going? Hello, Julia. We used to work together in Juneau.
Oh, hi.
Yeah, so anyway, I was, in your introduction, Lori, you mentioned that you'd seen people crowdsourcing recipes and stuff like that on Facebook and those kind of deals. I've seen some of the canning sites, and one thing I wanted to stress as a safety thing is people should be more conscious of looking at what the University of Alaska Fairbanks Cooperative Extension Service puts out as guidelines for a lot of the productions. They, for most of their, they have a national canning safety group down in Georgia that they also, the UAF group does the a lot of the wild game recipes for that book, So Easy to Preserve. But they have an online tutorial called Preserving Alaska's Bounty that is where you can go in and you can see how people are putting up different fish. And what's good about this site is these have all been safety tested, so you know that you're doing it the right way. You're not going to be... I see a lot of mistakes on some of these Facebook groups where people are turning the cans upside down, so you have a good chance that you're going to break your seal or your or they're giving it enough time in the canner, especially like if you're doing smoked salmon versus regular salmon in jars. You have about a 20-minute more time difference on how long it needs to process. And yeah, so you need to take that into account. And so I just wanted to make sure people are aware that if they are going to go into canning, you know, contact their local cooperative extension office to see if they have any classes coming up. If they don't, look at this Preserving Alaska's Bounty online tutorials. They also have a lot of literature that you can download for free off of their website, uaf.edu/CES for Cooperative Extension Service.
Great.
And then they also have that book, So Easy to Preserve. The UAF group did the wild game recipes that are in that book.
That's fantastic. Charles, thanks so much for the call and for that excellent advice. And it's a really important point because I grew up with my grandmother and my mom and my aunties. Everybody, we put a lot of stuff in jars. And, you know, there were very specific methods. Some things had to be pressure cooked, some did not. But that sort of fell by the wayside for a few decades. And now it's really gaining in popularity again, where people are engaging in canning again. But I have never been comfortable canning salmon or meats that have a really low acidity because it scares me. Mm-hmm. Things that are, you know, have vinegar, pickles, tomatoes, sure, that's easy and safe. But green beans, other things like that, that you really have to be careful with, I tend to freeze those instead. What's been your experience in trying? Do you can stuff, Julia? And if you do, what stuff are you, do you feel comfortable doing that with?
Oh man, I knew you were going to ask me that. Well, so I grew up with a lot of, I grew up with a sort of a jam making culture in my family. We're jammers. And I mean, I have these memories of my grandmother melting wax and like putting the wax and then the thing and, you know, all that stuff. I have aggressively canned tomatoes from other places. And just followed, you know, the hot water bath method. But I definitely, and then of course I made pickles and that kind of thing. But when I make jam, I tend to do small batches and just give them away for immediate consumption. Cause it, I kind of feel like jam, you make it and then, and this is also part of our food culture, is this like hoardiness where we're like, I'm gonna make this jam and I'm gonna put it up and then like then like 3 years later, it's like still there though.
So
there is like this kind of impulse that's like baked into how we live here, where we're like always kind of squirreling some stuff away, and you know, and there is like a pretty valid question about how necessary that is. Another thing that happens where you like, oh, it's March and you still got all that salmon in the freezer, you could have given it away when it was fresh, but you were like, no, I must have food for winter, you know. And so anyway, so I guess I would say the short answer is I'm not much of a canner.
I think that it's a fun process to do with kids, especially if you're making jam and things like that. It's so much fun to teach kids how to do those things. And I know that I have one hint that I'll share. If you have a lot of small cucumbers and you want to make pickles, the easiest way to do it is to put them in your washing machine, put cold water in there, agitate for just a couple minutes, knocks all those little bumps off. They're clean as a whistle. And then you can just put them in jars and start making your pickles.
Ooh, good tip. Another thing I do when I'm making jam, which is just like a side tip, is I put the jars in the dishwasher and I time it on the sanitize cycle. So then I can just pull those hot, clean jars right out of there and I don't have to mess around with them.
Yeah, that's a great idea, because what I normally do is put my jars upside down after they're washed in a big cookie or a cake pan on top of the stove with the burner on, water in there, and just keep them, you know, simmering a little bit so they're super hot and ready for whatever I'm putting in the jars. Let's go back to the phones. Rachel is in Fairbanks. Hi, Rachel.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
Hi, I'm calling from Fairbanks, and I wanted to share a new recipe that I kind of put together last summer. I was working up in Barrow, and probably one of the most abundant plants on the Arctic coastal plain is frigid coltsfoot. The Latin is Pedicytes frigidus, and I don't remember the native name, but it pretty much carpets the whole tundra in the middle of the summer, and I collected a couple gallon bags full and kind of fried it up on the stove with onions and garlic and threw it into a lasagna, actually.
Cool.
And it turned out really good. It's kind of like kale. It's a little less fibrous and not so stiff because it's kind of white and fuzzy on the underside, so it goes down really smooth. And it's really good raw if you just want something to chew on when you're walking in the tundra.
Have you ever tried making pesto with that?
You know, I haven't. I wonder if it would be a little too fibrous still.
Yeah.
That seems like a really good idea. Yeah.
Maybe in a Vitamix where it gets like really, really emulsified. But I've like been really curious about making pesto with that, or like a mixture of that and like you know, like a traditional thing, more, you know, like a basil or a tarragon or something.
And the name of it is Frigid Cold Coltfoot?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting. Well, that's a... a great tip, and it sounds like it was a really tasty recipe. Thanks, Rachel, for calling in.
Sure thing.
All right, let's go to Kenai now. We're going from Fairbanks to Kenai. Hi, it is Venetia, is that right?
Yes, thank you.
Hi, Venetia.
Have you ever heard of fish skin chips?
No, but I was really intrigued when I saw that come up on the screen. Tell us about that.
Oh, my lands. Well, I'll try and be quick. When I can fish, I take the skin off, and I didn't know what to do with them, so I just froze them. And when I thawed them out, I took, you know, when you descale, deslime, and then you skin the fish. Well, you do that on the inside, too. Take out every bit of fat, every bit of meat. It's just the skin, and cut it up into pieces and fry it, and when it stops sizzling, it's done. It takes 5 or 6 minutes, like kale chips, and then they stay crispy. As soon as you pull them out, sprinkle them with salt, and they stay crispy. I made probably 20 fish into fish skin chips. I was going to feed them to the dogs, and the kids ate them when they came in. All of them.
That's great.
So when I can, all those skins go in the freezer. I roll them up, and they go into the bag, and they go in the freezer. And then you just cut them into shapes or strips or whatever you want, and they really stay crispy.
That sounds delicious.
It does sound delicious.
And really intersects actually with the Japanese tradition of deep frying salmon skin. And actually, I wonder what that would be like at the center of like a just like a really simple sushi roll. Mm. Might be kind of crunchy and delicious. Yeah. Just saying.
Yeah, fish skin chips.
What was I going to say? They don't taste fishy.
Yeah.
There's no fish taste to them at all.
A little,
clean them well, like you're making a skin basket, a fish skin basket.
Yeah.
You really get them that clean.
Yum. They sound really good. Thanks for calling in with that. That's one of those things that I hadn't heard of before, so it's fun. Julia, is that something you've been familiar with?
Well, that deep fried salmon skin is a thing, but I don't know that it's necessarily, you know, quite made in the same way, but I've eaten it inside a sushi roll before. It's super delicious, actually. It just, you know, a little cow roast rice and roll it up.
All right, we're going to take another quick break. I wish I had enough time to run out and grab something to eat, but I guess we'll just have to continue on with our conversation as Talk of Alaska continues statewide.
Funding for Talk of Alaska was made possible in part by the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority and listeners just like you. Thank you.
We are back, and let's go back to the phones for just a moment. Nancy is in Homer. Hi, Nancy.
Hi. I wanted to talk about something that's happened in Homer. There is a program with the federal government to support people in building high tunnels. And that's the kind of metal-framed, plastic-covered greenhouse that you might see at Bell's Nursery or any commercial kind of thing. Well, over the last 7 years, there have been about 600 of these built by people in Homer through the NRCS.
600.
And it has completely changed the face of food here. Now we have an abundance. We all have extended seasons by 2 months at least. We're growing large quantities of food. We're sharing it with friends. The idea of fresh local food, not just from the farmer's market, but just much more broadly.
Well, and Nancy, tell me, beyond greens and herbs, what else are you able to grow in those high tunnels?
Tomatoes, squash, corn, fruit, a lot of fruit. A lot of people are planting fruit trees in their high tunnels.
Wow, that's fantastic.
Which are hard to grow in Homer.
Yeah.
You know, we have a marine climate, so we don't get real warm.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing, and so now there are all these classes, and the Homer Folk School is doing a whole series on fermentation, cheese making. We have a lot of root cellars are being built that people never quite got to before. Yeah.
Fantastic. Thanks so much for the call. 600 high tunnels. That's extraordinary.
It's
Julia.
It's the highest concentration, I think, in any community in the United States. And there is no question that Homer is sort of a laboratory for sustainability and local food. And in the state is just it's a really remarkable sort of micro economy that has taken hold there, and it's worth keeping an eye on. And climate change plays a role in it as well, just in terms of providing, especially with the sort of stabilization that comes with those hoop houses, but with providing just additional heat. So
Nancy mentioned root cellars, and I know that that's something that a long time ago people had them, and again, that kind of fell by the wayside, and now I think there's a bit of a rekindling of interest in having those kinds of cool spaces that you can keep things. What are some of the old-style methods that you've uncovered that are still in use, and maybe some that are not, in your food research? Was sulfuring ever used here that you found, or are people still burying certain types of fish or seal flippers or things like that and fermenting them?
Well, that's certainly going on. And, you know, barrel aging. I have seen lots of barrel aging, hopefully not plastic bucket aging, although that does take place as well. And I have seen it, I guess, now that I'm thinking back, of marine mammal, different types of marine mammals. I have seen that. Using of the Kanishak, the like Arctic entry, as like a big freezer, that's another kind of fun thing. And I don't know whether like the temperature there is, you know, I don't know exactly how climate change is affecting the kind of regulation of the temperature of just using the outside as a freezer. That's kind of an interesting thing. A lot of my cookbook research has been looking more at food preparation. But one of the things that you do see, which is interesting, is kind of a shift that happens after World War II, when there was a big push to extend refrigeration to the rural parts of America. So that's when we start seeing like the use. I was really into like trying to find the origins of halibut Olympia, which is like a kind of a nostalgic Alaskan thing, not just Alaskan, but we do eat that here. And you can sort of start to trace it back to the emergence of brands, you know, food branding, which is kind of a thing that happened, you know, after World War II. And then you can see the influence of refrigeration and the use of mayonnaise in a lot of dishes is like something that started to change in Alaska's cooking at that point.
What in your research have you found to be maybe the most versatile Alaska ingredient?
Versatile?
Yeah.
Oh, man. I don't know. You know, certainly the most common is seafood, you know, would be salmon and whitefish of different kinds. One of the more surprising ingredients that's super duper common in the early part of the century is canned tomatoes and raisins, actually. Raisins and canned tomatoes appear in all kinds of funky and interesting uses. And it must have been both price and shelf stability and kind of availability that did that. But I found a dozen, 15 different recipes for the cooking of halibut in a red sauce that may or may not include raisins. That's like an interesting kind of funky thing. And also the use of raisins in replacing any other fruit in like a pie or that kind of a thing. So the resaturation of raisins and using raisins in everything is like kind of a thing that happened in the early century.
All right, let's go back to the phones for a moment. Jeff is in Anchor Point. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, Lori, and to the other ladies as well. Yeah, I just want to throw out something like I kind of quit canning fish, wondering, you know, how much is left nutritional-wise as you're eating that thing, whatever, and those lids don't even seal till later, you know, in the process. How much is, half the nutrition's in that water in the canner to where I'm freezing fish, and, you know, like a person doesn't have the vacuum pack capabilities, you know, assuming they have refrigeration, is like putting a, you know, whatever fish in a, you know, a Ziploc, and filling the Ziploc with water, leaving, you know, some headspace for expansion, and it just keeps, you know, it's good, or maybe it's better than vacuum pack, and then you got a hedge if the electricity goes out, you got all that extra. Ice there to keep things for a few days. Granted, it takes up more space, but, you know, that's the trade-off.
Wow, cool. That's an interesting idea, and I could see why that would help you avoid food loss in the short term with that big block of ice. One of the things that my brother advocated for, if you don't have vacuum sealers, as Jeff was discussing, is to take your fish, put it in a plastic bag, and set it down in a sink full of water. And that just pushes all the air out, and then you can just seal that bag up, and there's not air in there. So that can be your low-budget vacuum seal method.
Cool.
is just putting it in water. Let's stay with the phones for a moment. Susan is in Anchorage. Hi, Susan.
Hi. I tuned in a little late, so I don't know if you covered this, but I'd like you to make sure we have an email if we want to send you a recipe. I have a special one I'd like to send in. I went to high school in Ketchikan in the 1960s, and Mrs. Sun was a head cook, and her husband was our Norwegian halibut fisherman. So once a month, fresh halibut was on the school lunch menu. And she served it with boiled new potatoes and parsley and garlic bread and spinach and lime jello for dessert. But this halibut was so special that at all our class reunions, it's always been the main course. So can you give us an email we can send our recipes to?
Yeah, you can send them to jomallely@adn.com.
Okay, that sounds great. I'll be sending this one in.
All right, thanks, Susan, for the call. And there you go, Julia, got another submission for a recipe. Have you, talk about some of the more exotic Alaska fare, gumboots, sea cucumbers. What's been your experience in either cooking or eating those types of things from the sea?
I haven't eaten the sea cucumbers, but I know they're like that there's a market for them. I have a friend who got really super sick eating them once. I don't know. I tend to not want to use the word exotic because it isn't quite how I feel when I'm like eating, you know, like seal or whale or fermented whale. But I certainly have eaten things in Alaska that are like outside of my usual comfort zone. And all of it's been pretty good. I think the flavor profile of many of the things has been marine, kind of an herbal and salty marine flavor profile that might stretch, you know, from mikyuk, which is like fermented whale, to like
and blood.
And
right?
Yeah, I think so. And yeah. And also herring egg. I haven't had like really stinky stuff, but only because I haven't had the opportunity. Also, I'm allergic to shellfish, so I always get a little weirded out when there's like an animal that eats a lot of shellfish. But so far, so good on that. But yeah, so I don't know. There are a lot of like, you know, one thing that also is worth noting is just the difference in palates. We have a wide variety of different palates, but one of the things that interests me a lot is the development of a palate among Alaska Native children in urban Anchorage, how families go about developing a palate that understands the tastes of marine mammal early on, you know, and, you know, it's like to get a taste for whale and kind of the significance of that. It's not just, you know, because you want your kid to like that food, but also because that food has a cultural import and a historical meaning.
That's such an interesting thought. I'm sorry that we're going to have to leave it there, but the idea of being raised out of that being part of your normal food from the time you're very young and having to develop a taste for it because you weren't raised from birth with it. We'll have to continue that conversation in the future. Thanks so much to my guest today, Julia O'Malley, book author and journalist and also editor at the Anchorage Daily News, and Liz Snyder, associate professor of public health at UAA and a former Polar Lab scholar in residence at the Anchorage Museum. Thanks for all the calls. Sorry we didn't get to all of them, but thanks for tuning in and listening today. This has been Talk of Alaska. We'll be back next week. I'm Lori Townsend.
Talk of Alaska was made possible by Matson, committed to the communities it serves, building on more than 50 years of service to the communities of Alaska. Learn more at Matson.com. This program is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400. This is Alaska Public Media.